Chapter 18. Aligned to the club will always find me, but you don't seem to remember my existence nowadays, unless you want to get a tip out of me. The fact that the remark was in distinctly bad taste did not make it any easier to answer, for Lily was vividly aware that it was not the moment for that drawing up of her slim figure, and surprised lifting of the brows by which she usually quelled incipient signs of familiarity. "I'm very much flattered by your wanting to see me," she returned, essaying lightness instead. "But, unless you have mislaid my address, it would have been easy to find me any afternoon at my aunt's. In fact, I rather expected you to look me up there." If she hoped to mollify him by this last concession, the attempt was a failure, for he only replied, with the familiar lowering of the brows that made him look his dullest when he was angry, "And going to your aunt's, and wasting the afternoon listening to a lot of other chaps talking to you. You know I'm not the kind to sit in a crowd and jaw. I'd always rather clear out when that sort of circus is going on. But why can't we go off somewhere on a little lark together, a nice quiet little expedition like that drive at Bellomont, the day you met me at the station?" He leaned unpleasantly close in order to convey this suggestion, and she fancied she caught a significant aroma which explained the dark flush on his face, and the glistening dampness of his forehead. The idea that any rash answer might provoke an unpleasant outburst tempered her disgust with caution, and she answered with a laugh, "I don't see how one can very well take country drives in town, but I am not always surrounded by an admiring throng, and if you will let me know what afternoon you are coming, I will arrange things so that we can have a nice quiet talk." "Hang talking. That's what you always say," returned Trina, whose expletives lacked variety. "Why, you put me off with that at the Van Osburgh wedding, but the plain English of it is that, now you've got what you wanted out of me, you'd rather have any other fellow about." His voice had risen sharply with the last words, and Lily flushed with annoyance, but she kept command of the situation, and laid a persuasive hand on his arm. "Don't be foolish, Gus. I can't let you talk to me in that ridiculous way. If you really want to see me, why shouldn't we take a walk in the park some afternoon? I agree with you that it's amusing to be rustic in town, and if you like I'll meet you there, and we'll go and feed the squirrels, and you shall take me out on the lake in the steam gondola." She smiled as she spoke, letting her eyes rest on his in a way that took the edge from her banter and made him suddenly malleable to her will. "All right then. That's a go. Will you come tomorrow?" "Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, at the end of the mall. I'll be there sharp, remember. You won't go back on me, Lily?" But to Miss Bart's relief, the repetition of her promise was cut short by the opening of the box door to admit George Dorset. Trina sulkily yielded his place, and Lily turned a brilliant smile on the newcomer. As he had not talked with Dorset since their visit at Bellomont, but something in his look and manner told her that he recalled the friendly footing on which they had last met. He was not a man to whom the expression of admiration came easily. His long sallow face and distrustful eyes seemed always barricaded against the expansive emotions. But, where her own influence was concerned, Lily's intuition sent out thread-like feelers, and as she made room for him on the narrow sofa, she was sure he found a dumb pleasure in being near her. Few women took the trouble to make themselves agreeable to Dorset, and Lily had been kind to him at Bellomont, and was now smiling on him with a divine renewal of kindness. "Well, here we are, in for another 6 months of caterwauling," he began complainingly. "And not a shade of difference between this year and last, except that the women have got new clothes, and the singers haven't got new voices. My wife's musical, you know, puts me through a course of this every winter. It isn't so bad on Italian nights, then she comes late, and there's time to digest. But when they give Wagner, we have to rush dinner, and I pay up for it. And the drafts are damnable asphyxia in front and pleurisy in the back. There's Trina leaving the box without drawing the curtain. With a hide like that, drafts don't make any difference. Did you ever watch Trainer eat? If you did, you'd wonder why he's alive. I suppose he's leather inside too. But I came to say that my wife wants you to come down to our place next Sunday. Do for heaven's sake say yes. She's got a lot of bores coming, intellectual ones. I mean, that's her new line, you know, and I'm not sure it ain't worse than the music. Some of them have long hair, and they start an argument with the soup, and don't notice when things are handed to them. The consequence is the dinner gets cold, and I have dyspepsia. That silly ass Silverton brings them to the house, he writes poetry, you know, and Bertha and he are getting tremendously thick. She could write better than any of them if she chose, and I don't blame her for wanting clever fellows about. All I say is, don't let me see a meat. Apostrophe, the gist of this strange communication, gave Lily a distinct thrill of pleasure. Under ordinary circumstances, there would have been nothing surprising in an invitation from Bertha Dorset, but since the Bellomont episode an unavowed hostility had kept the two women apart. Now, with a start of inner wonder, Lily felt that her thirst for retaliation had died out. If you would forgive your enemy, says the Malay proverb, first inflict a hurt on him, and Lily was experiencing the truth of the apothegm. If S.E. had destroyed Mrs. Dorset's letters, she might have continued to hate her, but the fact that they remained in her possession had fed her resentment to satiety. She uttered a smiling acceptance, hailing in the renewal of the tie-in escape from Trainer's importunities. Meanwhile, the holidays had gone by and the season was beginning. Fifth Avenue had become a nightly torrent of carriages surging upward to the fashionable quarters about the park, where illuminated windows and outspread awnings beckoned the usual routine of hospitality. Other tributary currents crossed the mainstream, bearing their freight to the theaters, restaurants, her opera, and Mrs. Peniston, from the secluded watchtower of her upper window, could tell to a nicety, just when the chronic volume of sound was increased by the sudden influx setting toward a Van Osburgh ball, or when the multiplication of wheels meant merely that the opera was over, or that there was a big supper at Sherry's. Mrs. Peniston followed the rise and culmination of the season as keenly as the most active sharer in its gaieties. And, as a looker-on, she enjoyed opportunities of comparison and generalization such as those who take part must proverbially forego. No one could have kept a more accurate record of social fluctuations, or have put a more unerring finger on the distinguishing features of each season. Its dullness, its extravagance, its lack of balls or excess of divorces. S.E. had a special memory for the vicissitudes of the new people who rose to the surface with each recurring tide, and were either submerged beneath its rush, or landed triumphantly beyond the reach of envious breakers, and she was apt to display a remarkable retrospective insight into their ultimate fate, so that, when they had fulfilled their destiny, she was almost always able to say to Grace Stepney, the recipient of her prophecies, that S.E. had known exactly what would happen. This particular season Mrs. Peniston would have characterized as that in which everybody else poor except the Welly Brys and Mr. Simon Rosedale. It had been a bad autumn in Wall Street, where prices fell in accordance with that peculiar law which proves railway stocks and bales of cotton to be more sensitive to the allotment of executive power than many estimable citizens trained to all the advantages of self-government. Even fortunes supposed to be independent of the market either betrayed a secret dependence on it, or suffered from a sympathetic affection. Fashion sulked in its country houses, or came to town incognito, general entertainments were discountenanced, and informality and short dinners became the fashion. But society, amused for a while at playing Cinderella, soon wearied of the hearthside role, and welcomed the fairy godmother in the shape of any magician powerful enough to turn the shrunken pumpkin back again into the golden coach. The mere fact of growing richer at a time when most people's investments are shrinking is calculated to attract envious attention. And according to Wall Street rumors, Welly Bry and Rosedale had found the secret of performing this miracle. Rosedale, in particular, was said to have doubled his fortune, and there was talk of his buying the newly finished house of one of the victims of the crash, who, in the space of 12 short months, had made the same number of millions, built a house in Fifth Avenue, filled a picture gallery with old masters, entertained all New York in it, and been smuggled out of the country between a trained nurse and a doctor, while his creditors mounted guard over the old masters, and his guests explained to each other that they had dined with him only because they wanted to see the pictures. Mr. Rosedale meant to have a less meteoric career. He knew he should have to go slowly, and the instincts of his race fitted him to suffer rebuffs and put up with delays. But he was prompt to perceive that the general dullness of the season afforded him an unusual opportunity to shine, and he set about with patient industry to form a background for his growing glory. Mrs. Fisher was of immense service to him at this period. As he had set off so many newcomers on the social stage, that she was like one of those pieces of stock scenery which tell the experienced spectator exactly what is going to take place. But Mr. Rosedale wanted, in the long run, a more individual environment. He was sensitive to shades of difference which Miss Bart would never have credited him with perceiving, because he had no corresponding variations of manner. And it was becoming more and more clear to him that Miss Bart herself possessed precisely the complementary qualities needed to round off his social personality. Such details did not fall within the range of Mrs. Peniston's vision. Like many minds of panoramic sweep, hers was apt to overlook the minutiae of the foreground, and she was much more likely to know where Carrie Fisher had found the Welly Brise chef for them than what was happening to her own niece. She was not, however, without purveyors of information ready to supplement her deficiencies. Grace Stepney's mind was like a kind of moral flypaper, to which the buzzing items of gossip were drawn by a fatal attraction, and where they hung fast in the toils of an inexorable memory. Lily would have been surprised to know how many trivial facts concerning herself were lodged in Miss Stepney's head. She was quite aware that she was of interest to dingy people, but she assumed that there is only one form of dinginess, and that admiration for brilliancy is the natural expression of its inferior state. She knew that Gertie Farish admired her blindly, and therefore supposed that she inspired the same sentiments in Grace Stepney, whom she classified as a Gertie Farish without the saving traits of youth and enthusiasm. In reality, the two differed from each other as much as they differed from the object of their mutual contemplation. Miss Farish's heart was a fountain of tender illusions, Miss Stepney's a precise register of facts as manifested in their relation to herself. As he had sensibilities which, to Lily, would have seemed comic in a person with a freckled nose and red eyelids, who lived in a boarding house, and admired Mrs. Peniston's drawing room, but poor Grace's limitations gave them a more concentrated inner life, as poor soil starves certain plants into intenser efflorescence. As he had in truth no abstract propensity to malice, she did not dislike Lily, because the latter was brilliant and predominant, but because she thought that Lily disliked her. It is less mortifying to believe oneself unpopular than insignificant, and vanity prefers to assume that indifference is a latent form of unfriendliness. Even such scant civilities as Lily accorded to Mr. Rosedale would have made Miss Stepney her friend for life. But how could she foresee that such a friend was worth cultivating? How, moreover, can a young woman who has never been ignored measure the pang which this injury inflicts? And, lastly, how could Lily, accustomed to choose between the pressure of engagements, guess that as he had mortally offended Miss Stepney by causing her to be excluded from one of Mrs. Peniston's infrequent dinner parties? Mrs. Peniston disliked giving dinners, but as he had a high sense of family obligation, and on the Jack Stepney's return from their honeymoon she felt it incumbent upon her to light the drawing room lamps, and extract her best silver from the safe deposit vaults. Mrs. Peniston's rare entertainments were preceded by days of heart-rending vacillation as to every detail of the feast, from the seating of the guests to the pattern of the tablecloth, and in the course of one of these preliminary discussions she had imprudently suggested to her cousin Grace that, as the dinner was a family affair, she might be included in it. For a week the prospect had lighted up Miss Stepney's colorless existence. Then she had been given to understand that it would be more convenient to have her another day. Miss Stepney knew exactly what had happened. Lily, to whom family reunions were occasions of unalloyed dullness, had persuaded her aunt that a dinner of smart people would be much more to the taste of the young couple, and Mrs. Peniston, who leaned helplessly on her niece in social matters, had been prevailed upon to pronounce Grace's exile. After all, Grace could come any other day. Why should she mind being put off? It was precisely because Miss Stepney could come any other day, and because she knew her relations were in the secret of her unoccupied evenings, that this incident loomed gigantically on her horizon. She was aware that she had Lily to thank for it, and dull resentment was turned to active animosity. Mrs. Peniston, on whom she had looked in a day or two after the dinner, laid down her crutch at work and turned abruptly from her oblique survey of Fifth Avenue. Gus Treanor? Lily and Gus Treanor? She said, growing so suddenly pale that her visitor was almost alarmed. Oh, Cousin Julia. Of course I don't mean I don't know what you do mean, said Mrs. Peniston, with a frightened quiver in her small fretful voice. As such things were never heard of in my day. And my own niece. I'm not sure I understand you. Do people say he's in love with her? Mrs. Peniston's horror was genuine. Though she boasted an unequaled familiarity with the secret chronicles of society, she had the innocence of the schoolgirl who regards wickedness as a part of history, and to whom it never occurs that the scandals she reads of in lesson hours may be repeating themselves in the next street. Mrs. Peniston had kept her imagination shrouded, like the drawing room furniture. She knew, of course, that society was very much changed, and that many women her mother would have thought peculiar were now in a position to be critical about their visiting lists. She had discussed the perils of divorce with her rector, and had felt thankful at times that Lily was still unmarried. But the idea that any scandal could attach to a young girl's name, above all that it could be lightly coupled with that of a married man, was so new to her that she was as much aghast as if she had been accused of leaving her carpets down all summer, or of violating any of the other cardinal laws of housekeeping. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.